Good morning. It's a tough act to follow George Washington. I'll try. As the historian Merrill Peterson aptly observed, Thomas Jefferson is the mirror in which each generation finds reflected its most urgent concerns. As our recent election so vividly testifies, character is very much on the minds of Americans today. So, what does Jefferson have to say to us about character? I think a great deal. Over a long life of public service and private reflection, Jefferson considered the full range of virtues that would ensure the happiness and liberty of the American people. And like George Washington, he too insisted that happiness could never be achieved and preserved without the exercise of virtue. To be sure, not everything Jefferson has to say to us is welcome to us as conservatives, unlike, I think, Washington, who has the easier job there. But then there's Teddy Roosevelt coming up next. At times, he flirted with the more radical strains of Enlightenment thought, especially in his hostility to Orthodox Christianity, his attack on received opinion and tradition, and, as Matt Spaulding pointed out, Washington's warnings against a spirit of innovation, which Jefferson wholeheartedly embraced. But much of what Jefferson has to say offers a useful starting point for thinking about the character of a free people. As others will address the moral virtues of economy and charity, and because time is so short, I shall focus on Jefferson's proposals for fostering civic virtue, that is, for engendering those habits and qualities that are necessary to preserve republican government. Alone among the founders, Jefferson took the natural right of self-government literally. It was not enough for him that Americans establish a representative democracy. Republican government would require the direct participation of citizens in those public matters that were within their reach and competence. For Jefferson, the heart and soul of republican government lay not in the Constitution or in the structures of representative democracy, as important as they were, but in the manners and spirit of the people. Keeping that spirit alive once the Revolution became a distant memory was the central challenge of republican government. What were the dangers for Jefferson? And here he certainly, I think, stands alone in his prescriptions. The principal danger was civic lethargy and the inevitable shift of attention away from politics to more mundane matters, that is, making money. And many of you will recall Jefferson in the Notes on Virginia saying, now is the time to fix our liberties, for after the revolution is over, it will all be going downhill, and the people will devote themselves simply to the art of making money. This is one argument that probably does not sit well with many conservatives. But in recent years, as the country for the first time ever in known history has attained unimagined levels of prosperity, and psychiatrists and psychologists have recently begun to treat sudden wealth syndrome in children, Jefferson's warnings about the corrosive effects of luxury and wealth seem not to be as crazy as they probably seemed in 1782 when he first uttered these lines. Whatever his worries about the corrosive effects of wealth and luxury for republican government, it's also important to keep in mind Jefferson's views on taxes and private property. In his view, The first responsibility of government was to ensure that individuals are guaranteed the fruits of their labor, that taxation was to be kept light, and he deemed it the glory of America that ordinary citizens never saw a federal official or a tax collector. So although he warned about the dangers of wealth, it's also the case that politically, he was not prepared to take any steps against wealth. The kind of wealth I think that he warned most about was inherited, the inherited wealth that one saw in aristocracies. In a society where people were free themselves through their own labor to establish their fortunes, Jefferson was much more indulgent of that, even as he continued to warn that luxury and wealth might undermine the character of a free people. Unlike his great friend and colleague, James Madison, Jefferson did not fear majority faction. He worried more that the majority would lose interest in politics and that, as they did, their representatives would become corrupt. Surveying the electoral situation in 1800, Jefferson recognized the emergence of political parties based on distinct geographic divisions. We might say, what else is new? And concluded that the only way the country could be governed was if the federal government limited its powers and did not try to extend its reach. Otherwise, he feared, we would deteriorate into tyranny and further corruption. In words that seem prophetic, he wrote, "Our country is too large to have all its affairs directed by a single government. Public servants at such a distance and from under the eye of their constituents must, from circumstances of distance, be unable to administer and overlook the details necessary for good government, and by rendering detection impossible to their constituents, will invite the public agents to corruption, plunder, and waste." He too, as Matt Spaulding pointed out, would have railed against the bureaucratic state. One of his first acts as president was to try to undo the patronage machine set in motion by the Federalist administration preceding him, and to return power to the people and to shift it away from the really tiny bureaucracy that was already developing around the federal government. So how did he hope to keep this Republican spirit alive? Once again, I have the task of pointing out what is probably obvious to all of you, and that is that not all of Jefferson's proposals are equally worthy or equally defensible. Of course, the first way, chronologically, in which he tried to keep Republican spirit alive was his enthusiasm for armed rebellion, his defense of Shays' rebellion. It's, I think, important to point out that he was at a comfortable remove in Paris. And it's also interesting that John Adams in London also, at first, did not see the real danger of Shays' rebellion from that distance. When he came back to the United States, however, he took a very different view, especially when Federalists were rioting during his own administration. So I think in part one can explain these things simply by a comfortable distance and perhaps too close a familiarity with French radicals. It was at this time that he uttered the words that were to be imprinted on Timothy McVeigh's shirt, "The Tree of Liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is its natural manure." Later, he backed away from such incendiary statements, and one can say much thanks for that. Nevertheless, he continued to emphasize the necessity of armed citizens as a first defense of freedom. Another way in which Jefferson sought to rekindle civic spirit, or to keep it alive, was another of these crazy proposals to remake the Constitution every generation. And he addressed himself with all of his great scientific and mathematical rigor to figuring out exactly how many years constituted a generation. At first it was 34, then he backed it off, and it was only 19 later on. But every generation ought to be able to remake the Constitution, and no generation should bind another. He also extended that to debts, and one might think, of the great Ponzi scheme that is Social Security in terms of saddling future generations with responsibilities. If one peels away the obvious difficulties with Jefferson's proposals for remaking the Constitution every generation, or for relieving one generation of any responsibility for another generation, which of course I think are too extreme, nonetheless, I think Jefferson also raises a serious question for self-governing societies, and that is, who will have the power to alter our fundamental constitutional understandings? For societies do have to adapt and adjust. And if people do not do it through the amendment process, then, as we've seen in the 20th century, the courts will be all too happy to step in and do it for us. And so Jefferson's insistence on the need to amend the Constitution and to remind us that when we need to make fundamental changes in our society, which should not be undertaken lightly, but when we need to make them, it is probably better to do it by consulting the American people and moving through the cumbersome amendment process, which takes a long time effect to change public opinion and to move through the system, rather than appealing to courts for an instant decision. A third way in which Jefferson thought to rekindle civic spirit was, of course, through education. And Jefferson was one of the earliest of the framers to support universal education for boys and for girls. The key to fostering civic virtue, he thought, was a basically a civic education, one that would stress for Americans a knowledge of history. And what he meant by history was principally a history of free societies, which he included four: Greece, Rome, England, and America. This was to be one of the key ingredients of every young Virginian's education. A knowledge of how liberties are preserved and lost is essential to the preservation of a free society. And one, I think, can see in some way the ill effects of that today. I mean, as a professor at one of the leading liberal arts colleges in the nation, to be addressing students who have no idea how our constitutional system works, to ask them when we start reading the Federalist Papers, how many of you have ever read any of them in your AP courses in American history, and to have maybe one hand go up, and then further to say, well, how many papers have you read? One, Federalist 10. So these are our next generation of bright students who really have no idea of why the Senate is elected in the way that it is, how the Electoral College originally worked, how it works, any of the procedural and constitutional forms that Tocqueville warned were so essential to the preservation of a free society, that a democratic society would need forms, and yet we have so little understanding of them that it's very easy, as soon as our will is thwarted, as it was in this election, and we see the popular vote 10 tending in one direction, the Electoral College vote tending in another direction, to say, well, let's get rid of the thing that's confusing us, rather than say, how can we learn why we have this thing? What good is it? The only thing the television is telling us is that it will be impossible to get rid of it. But it would be good if they were to address themselves to the question of why the Founding Fathers thought we should have it in the first place. So a knowledge of how our liberties are preserved and lost was an essential ingredient of Jefferson's civic education. I also found it interesting in preparing my remarks to note that Jefferson, in his Rockfish Gap statements later in his life, when he reflected further on education, made the following observation, that another purpose of education would be to teach young citizens how to exercise discretion in the selection of their public officers, and to display diligence, candor, and judgment in assessing their performance in office. Finally, the fourth proposal, the way in which Jefferson sought to keep alive the spirit of civic virtue on which he rested the preservation of our free institutions, was by a defense of local self-government. This was Jefferson's most original proposal for keeping alive civic spirit. Jefferson trusts the people, in a phrase that resonates from some of the ads we saw on television for George Bush. Jefferson trusts the people to make their own decisions about matters closest to them, about public safety, about the education of their children, about the care of the poor. For Thomas Jefferson, the federal pyramid extends down to the grassroots, where the spirit of liberty is nurtured among citizens and radiates upward, renewing and refreshing the entire constitutional order. Thank you.